It's been another long week. We talked about student loan debt, lessons learned from political marches, and honoring MLK's legacy. So, as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and discuss some of the top stories from the past week. Time now for the break room.
It had nothing to do with blackface. Lawrence Dunbar is probably rolling over somewhere because it's not contextually accurate.
Currently, Georgians with qualifying conditions can possess cannabis oil in Georgia, but they have to break federal law to get it here.
Education in Kentucky is right now in limbo, and we want to make sure that our students get everything that they need.
Joining us to discuss those stories and more is Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington. Welcome back, Tanya.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Amber Scott of the nonprofit group Leap Year. Good morning, Amber.
Morning.
Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And with us, Georgia State University Professor Hector Fernandez. How's it going?
Great. Morning, everybody.
Morning, all. So this week we have been honoring Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. Wednesday marked 50 years since his assassination, but his legacy lives on.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
So how are we doing on that dream? A recent Associated Press poll finds that fewer than 1 in 10 African Americans believes that all or most of the goals of the civil rights movement have been achieved. Fewer than 1 in 10 African Americans believes all the goals or most of the goals have been achieved. Now, in contrast, about a third of white Americans believe that those goals have all been achieved. So, Tanya, what do you make of that discrepancy?
When I look at the recent rash of police shootings, it's clear to me that the color of people's skin is still being used as a yardstick for the value of their lives. And so it's very hard for me to say, given that reality, that we have realized the dreams that Dr. King spoke about. I mean, when your life is still vulnerable, that's a basic human right, the right to live. When your life is still vulnerable because of your race, that's, to me, signals that there's a lot of progress still left to be made.
Yeah, and there are a number of empirical measures that we could look at to prove precisely what you said. Sumaya, what do you make of the difference in perception among different groups of people as to where we are vis-a-vis the King dream?
Well, I think it's where they're at in society and what privileges does one group have over the other. Have we made any kind of headways in terms of civil rights? Well, on the surface, it looks like we have in terms of employment. We have employment laws, we have housing laws, et cetera. But when we dig deeper and we look at our school system, when we look at the education, when we look at our jails, and there is a huge disparity there. And then also, you know, it's no longer just black and white in the U.S. It's gotten more complicated. And the newcomers, the immigrants and people of other people of color in different religious traditions, et cetera, they are benefiting from the civil rights movement that Dr. King started. But again, we are not where we should be as a country. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
Many of those deep racial divisions that King spoke about are still very much alive, as evidenced perhaps this week during a Griffin, Georgia town hall meeting. Griffin recently declared April Confederate History Month, and in a public forum, one white former city commissioner spoke in support of Confederate History Month, and in addressing an African-American sitting commissioner, this former elected official used the N-word, not once, not twice, but three times, to describe how the city used to be. Now, Governor Nathan Deal did away with Confederate Memorial Day and Robert E. Lee's birthday as state holidays in 2015, still celebrated locally in a lot of places. Amber, does this incident prove Deal right?
I found, first of all, that video was pretty horrifying, especially since he was a former politician himself, right?
Yeah.
And so talking about that's how some of our leadership are still talking about our community, is pretty horrifying. And as a Black American, of course, I find the concept of, a Confederate History Month or Robert E. Lee Day pretty offensive. And yeah. I think regardless of the rationality, because people create all these rationalities around why it shouldn't be offensive and why, you know, this is okay to be celebrating. But the reality is, if doing something like that is going to create a situation where a large part of the population is feeling intense hatred and danger and like they can't leave the house because people are out here celebrating something that is so hurtful to us, why would you want to build rationalities around that? It should just be, you know, this is not something as a community we're going to support when it's so hurtful to this large population of our community.
Hector, we got a minute left before we got to take a break, but any quick thoughts on that video from Griffin or the topic of Confederate Memorial Day?
Basically, I mean, if your notion of the past is that you fail to acknowledge that the Civil War was fought over slavery or that the entire economy of the South was based on the exploitation of one race by another, I mean, you should not be allowed to celebrate that twisted understanding of the past, basically.
Let's head up I-75 from Griffin to Atlanta, where rental rates are soaring so high that Atlanta is being compared unfavorably to San Francisco.
But it all boils down to one thing. Rent. It's too damn high.
According to an investigation by 11 Alive, East Atlanta Village is seeing the biggest rent surge in Atlanta. Rates for a one-bedroom zoomed up nearly 11% over the last year. A one-bedroom there will now cost you $1,700. That's for a gentrifying neighborhood. This is to say nothing of neighborhoods that have always been pricey, like Morningside, where the average one-bedroom is what? $3,600. So, panel who is all up there in Atlanta, while I sit here in Macon, where my mortgage on my beautiful historic house is $700 a month.
Wow. Don't brag.
Let's move down.
I'm going to brag. No. I will brag. What could or should be done about this, aside from becoming, you know, moving down here and becoming my neighbor in Macon?
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. Firstly, I live in East Atlanta Village, and I didn't even know that it had gone that high.
Yeah.
That's horrible. And, you know, I keep seeing them building more they're building more condos on Memorial now, and I'm just like, who is buying that? Like, I don't understand where these people are coming from.
They have to be coming from outside of Atlanta with salaries that allow them to pay these increasingly rising rents. And the mortgages, we're seeing the same thing on the mortgage side. And if we don't do something, then the people who have made Atlanta what it is will not be able to live in Atlanta. And at first, this was just affecting really poor people. And so there wasn't as much interest in addressing the housing affordability crisis and housing justice issues. Now it's about to affect everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, a southern city going to do rent control? Hector, is that a reasonable expectation?
Why not? I mean, it sounds like a good idea to me. I mean, it needs to be stopped at some point. I mean, the government has to intervene. Rent control works great in New York City.
Yep. It does.
Well, and we also need to advocate for the creation of more affordable housing. We have people who've been living in these communities for generations who are getting priced out. And so, you know, we need to be advocating our government and nonprofits for creating more affordable housing so that it's not just, you know, little bubbles of super wealthy communities. And it's actually, you know, reflects the city and the population who lives here.
You know, that was a real shocker for me as well when I read that story. And I live in Smyrna, so I Googled what's the rent rates in Smyrna. And it turns out that it's around $1,000 for a two-bedroom apartment in Smyrna. So people move on down to Smyrna.
Indeed.
Or Macon.
So many nice places to live in this country. There really are. Let's talk about another really interesting story. A month after West Virginia teachers went on strike for higher pay, Oklahoma and Kentucky teachers followed suit. Every public school in Kentucky and many schools in Oklahoma were shut down as a result. No teachers, no classes. That big strike, statewide teacher strike in West Virginia, worked. Teachers basically got the contract that they wanted from their state legislators. Here, let's go and look at the situation in Kentucky. Here's Melissa Sheets, who is a grade school teacher in Kentucky, who is striking.
I pray and I hope that our legislatures listen and they fully fund our schools. Kentucky's ranked 47th in per pupil funding. And in order for our students to be successful, they need top dollar. We're not an afterthought. We are not something that you can put at the bottom of the bucket.
So what's remarkable to me about this movement is that it's happening in southern states, where teachers' unions, for a variety of reasons, are not nearly as strong as they are in their northern counterparts, generally speaking. This seems really remarkable. Tanya, is this something that you think could spread to even Georgia?
Well, I'm proud that our governor has decided to fully fund K through 12 for the first time in a very long time. And I know
explain to people what you mean by fully fund, though. That's a subjective.
Well, fully funding it in terms of the standard amount that has been decided as being sufficient to finance the operation of our K through 12 schools. And so more money will be devoted to that, which will include additional money for teachers' salaries, because I believe when teachers aren't paid well, our students' education is compromised. So I know people are concerned that the schools are closed and so kids aren't being educated, but they're not being educated if the teachers are not being paid a livable wage or paid even enough to provide the education that they need to provide for our students so they can become productive members of society going forward.
And if we don't pay teachers, people are not going to take on that profession. And then what's going to happen to our education system? And if we really want to keep America great, we need to concentrate on education and put that as a priority versus not.
Absolutely.
Adam, one thing, the fact that it's happening in so many southern states has quite a bit to do with right-to-work laws. You know, right-to-work laws did not work well for educators. They, in many cases, prevent the defense of their interest.
Let me just define that for people, because right-to-work is sort of a, I don't think that's a neutral description. I know why you're using it. That's how people have come to term refer to these laws. But essentially, these are laws that go back to the mid-20th century that, in some cases, prevent people, employees of any given profession or workplace from being required to join the union that is representing their interests. And it has, in effect, prevented teachers' unions in Georgia, among other states, from being a very powerful force. Sorry, go ahead, Hector.
No, that's precisely the point. I think the fact that it's happening in the southern states shows that the lack of unions, you know, at some point it has to show up, you know. When people have no resources to defend as a group, sooner or later, they embrace, you know, what is only logical to try to improve their standard of living because, you know, they haven't received a hike in quite a while.
If you're just joining us, we are in the break room talking about the week's news with Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington, Amber Scott of the nonprofit Leap Year, Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, and Hector Fernandez, professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University. All right, one more education story. An Atlanta charter school got a major backlash for a performance in which students wore masks representing blackface. And I'm not just talking about black faces, but masks representing actual minstrel show style blackface. Both African-American and white students held up the masks while they recited the poem "We Wear a Mask." Here is part of their performance. A teacher who had these students wear blackface while reciting this poem is herself African-American, and she says that she was trying to use this costuming to shed light on the, quote, non-pretty aspects of black history. The charter school is apologizing profusely. Amber, do you think that they should be?
So I think that they should be apologizing. I think that this is a really good case of... You know, intentions, again, regardless of your intentions or rationality, this was a big lapse in judgment. The optics were just so bad. It was really offensive to a lot of people and for good reason. And so I think it's a really good lesson for all of us. And regardless of whether or not the conversation is minority-led or not, regardless of the intentions behind it, we really have to get as many folks involved and really be thoughtful and reflective on what we're doing when we're talking about race, just to make sure that we're not, you know, having these lapses in judgment. And just the one other quick point I would make, though, is this story did go viral, you know, went all across social media. Mm-hmm. But a lot of outrage, a lot of people were outraged without actually knowing the full story behind it. So I also, you know, not to kind of justify the actions, but there is, the story is more complex than folks on social media would lead it to believe. And I think it is important to really understand the full context of what's going on before folks kind of pass these stories around on the internet.
And my issue with it is a complete distortion of the poem. That's Langston Hughes's poem talking about why Black people are forced to perform in certain ways in a society that doesn't allow them to be their full human selves, because to do so would have threatened this order that relegated them to second-class status. So she didn't understand the poem. And there's a lesson in that. The students could have learned why people feel like they have to wear masks, not minstrel masks, but masks that are imposed by systemic discrimination. So this young lady, God bless her, really needs to read more of Langston Hughes and some other Renaissance writers to understand what they were trying to say, and then share that with her students.
And what surprised me is that the school is going to do cultural competency training for their teachers. It's almost like going to the doctor with something wrong with my foot and he gives me a medicine for my heart. So, you know, there's a disconnect there.
And not even medicine.
That's right.
Well, and, you know, and this is such a pretty deep and abstract concept, you know, for second graders to be trying to, you know, perform this. I also wonder, you know, I know her intentions were good, but this is also, again, like the student should be at an age where they themselves can understand what it is that they're talking about and performing. And there, and you know, that there was such a disconnect there as well with these second graders who are essentially reciting something that they themselves don't even understand and holding up these masks. And it was just all bad.
I should mention that I think we said a moment ago that the poem was by Langston Hughes. It's actually by Paul Lawrence Dunbar. But it's okay. It's all the more. This is all an example of why we all need to get an edit, right?
Absolutely.
Whenever you're going to do anything remotely racially sensitive,
exactly,
always have someone else look at it for you. I have found that out the hard way myself. Yeah, without a doubt. Okay, moving on. Okay, here's a really good, interesting Georgia news story. Republican State Representative Alan Peak from my neck of the woods in Macon is someone who, over the time in his time in the legislature, has really led the push for medical cannabis in Georgia. In 2015, a bill that he wrote became law. It allows people with certain conditions, like seizure disorders, to take and possess small amounts of cannabis oil. That can really, really help them. Federal law prohibits marijuana transport across state lines, and you still can't buy this cannabis oil in Georgia. But Peak personally distributes the oil to people in Georgia who need it, raising the question, how is he getting it? Peak claims, quote, "I don't have any idea how the product gets here in Georgia. Once we have it, we give it to families and citizens for free." Now, I should say, this is Peak's last year in the legislature. He is retiring. What do we make of his legacy in this area, Hector?
Great. I mean, he's actually not responsible for the product crossing state lines. That's not his doing, so it's perfectly okay. I think it's high time we legalize, you know, the production of cannabis oil within the state. I mean, lots of families need it. I can only endorse him. I think he's done great.
He had a tremendous fissure with Governor Deal over this issue over their time. Governor Deal really, really resistant to any kind of medical cannabis, you know, grudgingly signed this very, very limited measure that did pass. What do we make of the lingering, very, very strong opposition to medical marijuana among a lot of people across parties?
I think some people are afraid that it is going to lead to the full decriminalization of marijuana, even for recreational purposes. So, I mean, we just, within the past 10 years are allowed to purchase alcohol on Sundays,
yeah,
and only after 12:30. So, we're in the Bible Belt. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about something that serves a medicinal purpose for children, for people with seizures, for people who are HIV positive, it seems cruel to allow them to use it, but not to access it. And it just doesn't make sense. So we need to look at what other states are doing and follow suit.
Let's try to sneak in one more topic here. Big one. A lot of people in the media biz are talking about Sinclair Broadcasting Group. This is a broadcasting group that owns now more local TV stations than any other company in the country. And those stations' news anchors were required recently to read a script in a promo telling viewers about, quote, the troubling trend of irresponsible one-sided news stories plaguing our country and how it's, quote, extremely dangerous to our democracy. This went viral when the website Deadspin created a montage of anchors from across the country echoing the same lines in one big unanimous chorus. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Fox San Antonio's Jessica Headley.
And I'm Ryan Wolf.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our Treasure Valley communities,
the El Paso, Las Cruces communities,
Eastern Iowa communities,
Mid-Michigan communities.
We are extremely proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS 4 News produces.
But we are concerned about troubling trend and irresponsible one-sided news stories plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media.
Now, I'm concerned about bias and false news, too. I think a lot of people are.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Sinclair has gotten a lot of backlash for this because it's that whole promo is painted by the fact that this is a company that has, in various ways, I think it's fair to say, been in bed with the Trump campaign and then later the Trump administration, made special deals with them for more favorable content, more favorable coverage of the Trump campaign. Should that necessarily cause us to dismiss a relatively uncontroversial message that we need to be careful about sharing messed up fake news? What do you think, Samaya?
Well, I say that. Thank God for public broadcasting when I read this story.
Right answer.
So, you know, thank you. We all need to support public broadcasting. I agree with the Deadspin message that this is extremely dangerous to our democracy. And Sinclair is really, the stations are the ones who are promoting fake news. And it's just very troubling for me.
Hector, last word goes to you.
They should be fine. If they keep growing, antitrust measures should be contemplated.
All right. That's it for The Break Room today. Thanks to all my guests, Georgia State University Law Professor Tanya Washington, Amber Scott of the nonprofit Leap Year, Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, and Hector Fernandez, professor at Georgia State University. Have a great weekend, everybody.